This weekend starts right after this.
Everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. Here's an idea. Let's add, save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is, you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? It just may be the most rewarding to-do you do today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
New approach to autism. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
With autism being diagnosed at twice the rate of 12 years ago, one mother has changed her thinking about managing her son's condition. You'll hear about her natural approach.
As many schools begin standardized testing season, here's a question. Do students need what one person is calling a testing bill of rights?
It's one of the toughest fashions to conquer women's athletic wear. Find out why it's difficult for any one company to dominate.
And as baseball season kicks off in earnest, a look at the stadiums getting creative with hot dogs.
There is a company called Levy Restaurants that sells at 7 Major League Baseball stadiums around the U.S., and they go all out to try to create regional twists on the classic ballpark hot dog.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron takes us on a stadium hot dog tour. She's here later in the hour. Well, as you may know, April is Autism Awareness Month. Some are advocating a natural approach to managing autism. What exactly does that mean? We're joined now by Dr. Janet Lintola, author of a brand new book called The Unprescription for Autism, A Natural Approach for a Calmer, Happier, and More Focused Child. She's close to the issue since one of her children has autism. Doctor, what's the message in the book?
The message is that these children and adults are challenged by a ton of invisible health problems that we don't typically think of when we picture autism. We're focused on social skills and language, and really this student that's sitting there in front of a teacher or in front of the therapist or trying to play with friends might struggle with a crushing burden of medical challenges.
All right, so what's a different approach, say, than what many folks use today or try today?
Well, typically, when you have a child with autism, we have some well-known issues if you're an autism parent. A lot of our children can't sleep very well, and there's a lot of exhaustion. They have a lot of gastrointestinal issues like acid reflux and constipation, which are painful and make them irritable and hard to concentrate. There's an immune subset of autism, so a lot of these kids have stuffy, runny noses, kind of headachey. They catch a lot of colds or have allergies. Food sensitivities, they're overwhelmed with sensory issues. And when we take our children to the doctor and we say, my child can't sleep or can't poop or can't behave, we are handed this standard trio of prescriptions. A sleeping pill, we're told to give them a laxative on a daily basis, and often they're given very strong antipsychotics, even in children as young as 2 and 3 years old on the spectrum.
Wow.
And my point in my book is I don't think we're asking the right questions. I'm not anti-medicine, but instead of saying which prescription should my child take, I think a better question is why can't my child sleep or have a bowel movement or have a good day and not be so irritable or even aggressive?
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. Janet Lintola. She's the author of a new book called The Unprescription for Autism, A Natural Approach for a Calmer, Happier, and More Focused Child. Wow. All right. So I guess in theory here, and I think you just said it, that their therapy or progress could be slowed down simply because of the fact that they're physically uncomfortable, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Right. And then there's other issues, too. A fair number of them may have brain inflammation and oxidative stress. Sometimes that immune system turns against their own body tissues. There's a study that shows up to 8 different tissues in the brain can be attacked by their own immune system. The sensory issues are overwhelming for them.
Yeah.
There are some studies that have been coming out over the last couple of decades showing if their gut isn't working properly, some of the foods can form these opiate-like peptides that circulate up into the brain. All of this is going on in the brains of these kids, and you can't tell by looking. and we throw a ton of resources at it. We go, hey, let's get an IEP, let's get an aid, let's get some therapy. But what if that child felt good and had a clear brain and a good night's sleep and no discomfort? That child's ready to learn. We're not curing autism with anything I do in my book, but we're certainly setting them up to have a better day and a higher quality of life.
So when you talk about autism, do you discuss finding a cure? Do you discuss or debate management of it? How do you categorize or discuss autism?
I've been in the autism world for over 20 years now, and my viewpoint has shifted. You know, 10 years ago, there was this movement to defeat, prevent, cure, treat autism, and people with autism tell me that makes them feel broken or you know, unwanted. We realize it is not a curable type of condition. And so what I focus on now is more positive language.
Dr. Janet Lintola, the book is called The Unprescription for Autism. It's 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy for you to create your stunning website. Go to Wix.com and create your website today. It's easy and free. That's Wix.com.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
Schools are embarking on the season of standardized tests. I know my son has them starting next week. Here's a question posed by Jason Russell at the Washington Examiner. Do students need a testing bill of rights? Jason, what have you put together?
Yeah, well, it's not what I put together, but the Center for American Progress, a liberal group, put together a draft testing bill of rights. Essentially, they think that not just students, but parents and teachers as well need a sort of bill of rights that when it comes to standardized testing, to make sure that they're not being over-tested and not having too much time spent on tests in the classroom. So that's a real concern of many parents and teachers as well. So this is basically an opportunity for them to capitalize on that concern, especially as we enter lots of end-of-the-year testing.
Right. All right. So what would be in it if this thing were to be crafted?
Basically, they give a few examples of things like tests need to provide an objective measure of progress towards college and career readiness. You know, they need to have an education free of excessive test prep. Teachers should be able to have test scores be only one of many other measures of how well they're doing. And they need to, make sure that their personal information is protected when it comes to the results of tests. Parents should be able to know that, their data of their students' data is comparable to other data's and other schools and things like that. And they need to know that, like I said, not too much time is being spent on these tests and that we're not just teaching to the test when it comes to their education.
Right. So what is too much time on standardized tests? Anybody try to measure that?
I don't think anyone's tried to measure that specifically, but lots of the blame gets put on the federal government. But I think certainly hasn't helped. But mainly, I think the over-testing that we're seeing is coming from state and local tests that are designed to prepare students for the federal tests. So basically, there was a new law in December that replaced No Child Left Behind that tried to get at that problem by keeping these tests in place to make sure that we have comparable data across the states on how well students are doing. But at the same time, it gives states lots of money to analyze their testing systems, make sure there's no tests that are excessive or unnecessary going on, and so then we can start to stem this flow of unnecessary testing.
Mm. All right. So how did we get to this point? Because I don't remember this. This many standardized tests when I was growing up. How come we seem so inundated? At least my kids do.
Yeah, I think the impetus was the No Child Left Behind law passed in 2001. There was a lot of testing going on there, and essentially the federal tests were designed to say you know, this is an example of a good school, and this is how you should analyze your schools. And lots of states went with that and said, okay, this is how we're going to analyze teachers too. So, you know, there's lots of testing and lots of pressure put on those tests. So this new law takes a lot of the, you know, keeps that testing in place, but mainly as just a way to analyze how students are doing. But so there's not as much funding tied to the tests, and so the consequences of testing are now limited. So hopefully it should be improving in the near future.
All right. So the cynic in me says that the teachers' union might be behind this, so that there's not so many measurements, you know, on a teacher. I don't know, something like that. Could that be possible?
Certainly, they're involved. Definitely, they oppose. You know, the teachers don't want to be analyzed solely by testing. They want to have other factors in place. You know, generally, I'm a little cynical about that as well, because they like to put a lot of inputs into education into those measures, like how much is being spent rather than outcomes on how well students are doing.
Yeah.
But certainly, it's an interesting, you know, you get strange bedfellows with testing, because, you know, you get lots of parents, conservative and liberal, that just don't want to have too many tests and don't want, you know, teachers teaching to the test.
Yeah.
And teachers don't want to be analyzed solely by tests.
Mm.
So it's an interesting mix.
Right. We're speaking with Jason Russell, commentary writer for The Washington Examiner. He's got a piece entitled, Do Students Need a Testing Bill of Rights? All right. So what could happen here, Jason, in an ideal world, I guess?
You know, I think in an ideal world that, you know, definitely education should be as local as possible, that, you know, students, you know, when parents have an issue with a test, that they would be able to go to their local school board or go to the principal and have a conversation about those tests. But at the same time, that they would have a way to compare their testing results to, you know, someone on the other side of the country and still have a good idea of where their child is at. There is one test that is essentially, it's the nation's report card, which was seen as the gold standard of academic results. And there's no consequences tied to that test. So I think an expansion of that nation's report card testing could be an ideal solution here.
Thanks, Jason. Jason Russell at the Washington Examiner. 20 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Women's workout gear is a popular seller right now, but it can't look too athletic. This athleisure wear, as it's known, has got to be stylish if women, for example, are going to go out for juice or coffee after their gym class. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
There seems to be a problem with workout clothing. It's too sporty. It seems many gym-goers are more interested in fashion than function. Here with more on this trend is Sarah Germano of the Wall Street Journal. So what did you look at here, Sarah?
We're talking about something that's a little bit nebulous because it is a question of style, but a lot of retailers are saying that they're gravitating more towards these fashion-oriented brands and, you know, celebrity athleisure lines, like Rihanna has one with Puma, and Rihanna's a very talented woman, but she's not an athlete. And it's just something that the traditional sportswear brands are trying to wrap their heads around. I mean, these are all like big companies that have built their business being very proficient in high-level sports and technical fabrics and things like that. And, you know, there is still a great market for it. But where we get into this, you know, wider appetite for workout gear that is stylish, they're now, just now starting to realize, okay, we have more work to do to make our tank tops and sports bras and leggings appealing to the wide market of people who are looking for that kind of thing.
What is it we're looking for?
To some women I've spoken with, it's not so much that they're looking for specific features, but they don't want anything that looks too industrial. I spoke to this one woman that we quote in our story who works out, you know, 3 to 5 times a week. You know, she's always buying new sports bras, and she said she has trouble finding ones that, you know, look cool in her workout classes and don't look like, you know, she's doing something too athletic. The retailers I've spoken with as well say what tends to sell are clothes that have what they call like this to and fro element to them. Like, you can wear them in your class, but if you go out afterwards and, you know, are either having lunch or just going about your day and your sports bra is showing, you still look kind of chic. To some extent, it's a question of colors and piping and patterns and things like that. And, I mean, to each his own in terms of what's stylish, but the retailers are definitely saying that the fashion-oriented brands are gaining an edge over the traditional sportswear ones.
And you mentioned in your story there are upwards of 800 brands trying to jump onto this bandwagon.
Yeah, it's really proliferated over the last few years. 800 brands have been like sort of at the peak of what some of the industry trackers have measured. And, you know, some of the industry trackers I've spoken with have said that the market's consolidated a little bit, but that at least shows you, you know, there's so many different upstart companies trying to get into this trend. And you also have companies like Tory Burch and, you know, fashion-oriented brands that are trying to launch sports lines. And that's just created a much more competitive marketplace. So, you know, the Nikes and the Adidases of the world have a lot more competition to deal with.
So does that mean companies like Nike, Under Armour, and Adidas are losing out?
There's definitely still a market for these brands. But the problem is that they're getting a lot more competition, and their management ranks are sort of retooling and refiguring out how they want to approach the women's market. One thing that they've noticed is because they do so much of their sale, like each of these companies do so much of their sales in menswear, they realize that their women's business has a lot of opportunity to grow, but they're also realizing it's easier said than done. And the last earnings call with Foot Locker, which, you know, sells a lot of these brands, they said that they sort of overestimated how much demand there would be for so-called performance apparel, you know, the stuff that's really for working out and, like, was not designed with any sort of stylish component in mind. So all of them are in touch with one another because they have vending relationships, and they're trying to figure out ways to make this their products for women more fashionable. And a lot of the people I've spoken to say, you know, that it's definitely not a market where you're seeing pressure on pricing. You know, even in Equinox and some of the other boutique stores I've spoken to, you know, women will pay upwards of $100 for a pair of leggings if they feel like it works. It's almost like they're getting, you know, two different features out of it. So we're not seeing the sort of price pressure that you're seeing in other parts of the apparel market. That's the fast fashion, the H&Ms and the Topshops and the Forever 21s of the world have really sort of wreaked havoc on other competitors like the Gaps and the J.Crews and things like that. So for the moment, you know, athleisure is in, and if people are willing to spend money for products that they see as being both functional and fashionable.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshinka with the Wall Street Journal's Sarah Germano. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Sometimes it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day, right? Even when you're working past the 9 to 5. So if you're still making some time-consuming trips to the post office, you need a better way. Use Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, get the postage you need the instant you need it. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. It's quick and easy. You'll save money with Stamps.com, too. It's just a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Plus, you'll get special postage discounts you can't even find at the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A four-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Get started with Stamps.com today. Within minutes, you'll be printing postage right from your desk. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com. Enter Deal. Well, how good are your business networking skills? Do you need some improvement? Dr. Ivan Meisner is known as the father of modern networking. He's got a book called Avoiding the Networking Disconnect, the three R's to reconnect. Ivan, is the art of face-to-face gone?
I see an integration of both online and face-to-face networking. Technology has flattened the communication hierarchy. It's enabled us to connect in a way that we could never have connected when I started an organization called BNI 31 years ago. We could have never connected the way we can now online, but nothing beats face-to-face. Face-to-face networking is very powerful. You meet someone, shake their hands, look them in the eyes. That's not going anywhere.
Yeah, and why not? Why can't that be replaced?
Well, you know, so I had a young 20-something-year-old in Sweden a few years ago come out to interview me, and the first thing he said was, you know, you're in the buggy whip business of the networking industry. And I said, excuse me?
Whoa.
He said, well, you know, when horse and carriage was replaced by automobiles, the buggy whip industry went away.
Oh, my goodness.
And social networking is going to completely put away face-to-face networking. I said, it took you an hour and a half to get here to interview me. Why did you come here to do the interview? He said, well, because my boss said I had to. I said,
oh,
I get
wow.
it that you're not impressed with networking, but why did you come? Why didn't you just pick up the phone and call? He looked at me, Gordon, I swear, and he said, oh, well, because a face-to-face interview is always better.
Huh. Okay.
And I kind of shrugged, and he's like, oh, I get it. And it's the same. Nothing beats that face-to-face relationship. The online is a great way to stay connected, but meeting face-to-face is always more powerful.
Yeah. All right. So a lot of people tend to drop the ball at a networking event. You grab some business cards, you say hello, and then there's never any follow-up. Like, is there ever a time when too much time has passed between introductions to reach out to somebody?
Yeah, there is, you know, because we meet so many people at a networking event that sometimes we don't remember them just a few days later. So we have a system in the book that we call the 24/7/30. Approach to follow up. Within 24 hours, you got to drop them a note, either an email or a handwritten note, you know, something personal, making a connection. It was really good meeting you. Hope our paths cross again.
Mm.
Within 7 days, 24/7/30, within 7 days, connect with them on social media, connect with them on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, however they play on social media, connect with them that way. And within 30 days, reach out to them for a face-to-face meeting. If you don't live close to them, and then at least a Skype meeting. And whatever you do, don't try to sell to them. That's where networking really goes wrong.
Wow, interesting.
Is when people are trying, they meet, hey, my name's Ivan, it's good to see you again, let's do business. And they jump right into the sales mode.
Okay. So meaning what? That first one, you should be gauging what this person as a potential customer might need, or it really needs to be kind of the basics. How are you? Where are you from? Nice to talk to you. And then go for a sell at a later point, or what?
Yeah, it's about building a relationship. I think if you want to build a powerful personal network, you have to understand a concept I call the VCP process. Visibility, credibility, profitability. You first have to be visible. People have to know who you are and what you do. Then you have to establish credibility, where people know who you are, they know what you do, they know you're good at it. And only then can you get the profitability, where people know who you are, what you do, they know you're good at it, and they're willing to give you referrals on an ongoing basis. What tends to happen, though, is people use networking as a face-to-face cold calling opportunity. We came up with the term networking disconnect because I went to an event in London, 1,000 people in the audience. I said, how many of you are here today? Raise your hands, hoping to possibly sell something. Gordon, 1,000 people.
I was just going to say, yeah, probably 100%, right? Yeah.
I said, okay, great. Second question, how many of you are here today hoping to buy something? No one.
There's the disconnect, yeah.
Yeah, that's the disconnect. So what it's got to be about is building a relationship, because when you give a referral to someone, you give a little bit of your reputation away.
Thanks, Ivan. Ivan Meisner. The book is called Avoiding the Network Disconnect. A couple of good points in there, right? The 24/7/30 when you meet someone, and also that VCP you talked about, visibility, credibility, then profitability. 21 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Ever think that at this point our tech devices should be getting easier to use? Seems more and more of us are finding that managing things like our phones and tablets is getting further complicated, even ones with basic software. Haley Sukuyama at the Washington Post says it's a frequent complaint she's been getting from readers. Haley, explain.
Well, you know, I think this idea for this article kind of came about from my own experience of using software lately, and also from readers in my inbox. You know, just saying it's just really difficult sometimes to use the software that that comes on our smartphones and on our computers. And even though there's sort of an emphasis on clean design, that doesn't always make it usable.
So give it a for example.
For example, I think the root of this problem is that they're trying to put a lot more functions into our devices than necessarily they have been designed for. So an example is I was trying to snap a picture with my phone. I was at an event, and I was trying to catch a quick picture. And one way that you can launch the camera on your phone on a Galaxy, for example, is to double tap the home button. So that's great, right? That's a great shortcut. That's a great feature to have.
Mm-hmm.
But I lingered for just a little too long, and instead of pulling up the camera, I unlocked my phone with the fingerprint reader and missed the shot completely, which was really frustrating.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that is that's a design problem, right? You should be allowed as a user to hesitate for half a second rather than having to do everything exactly the way that they've designed it.
All right, so is anybody trying to tackle this?
So I talked to a couple of designers for this piece, and I asked them for recommendations of who they thought was actually doing design really well. It's a big challenge, right? Especially as you kind of think about we're going to do more on smaller screens, more on places that we aren't used to seeing screens, like our thermostats, our wrists, that sort of thing. And actually, one of the designers I was talking to said that he really thinks Tesla does a good job of communicating design clearly, which is, of course, what you want out of a car, right? You want to be able to get information as clearly and quickly as you can when you're driving.
Right.
And he just said he thinks that they are looking at design in a very kind of holistic way and in a way that everyday people can understand, which is sort of the important point.
Right. And one of the points is that we're just encountering design problems, I guess, too, because you point out this study about the Internet of Things where, what is it, 16% of people, right, just it's just too complicated to use something like that.
Yeah, they say that they, you know, gave things back because it was just too difficult for them to figure out how to, you know, set up their smart light bulb or set up their smart thermostat. Some people couldn't even connect to the Internet, which is sort of the main function of those devices, and I think also really points to a problem with the way that things are being designed right now.
We're talking with Haley Tsukuyama, technology reporter at The Washington Post. Her piece is called Why Apple and Google Are Struggling to Design Simple Software. The thing is, though, we're not turning back on this, right? It's not like there's going to be less technology in future devices. So how are we going to keep up, I guess?
Well, you know, I think, so I said in the piece, I think part of the problem is that, or not problem, but, you know, part of the issue is that companies are trying to pack more functions into things that aren't designed to take them necessarily, right? We're doing more on our smartphones than we've ever done before. So, you know, I think part of the solution could be things like Apple's new iPad Pro, right? Sort of swinging back from trying to get everything on the one small device and, you know, kind of going back to dedicated devices.
Thanks, Haley. Haley Tsukuyama at The Washington Post. It's 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to the state that went from 49th to 10th best in corporate business income tax, where 2,000 burdensome and unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years, and is now home to the 6th best entrepreneurial climate. All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice of your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Baseball has entered its first full weekend of the season, and you can't talk going to a major league park without bringing up the subject of hot dogs. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron has a look at how some stadiums are getting creative with how they're prepared. Ellen, what have you found?
There is a company called Levy Restaurants that sells at 7 Major League Baseball stadiums around the U.S., and they go all out to try to create regional twists on the classic ballpark hot dog.
Nice. All right, so what kind of regional twists did you discover?
Well, there's one in Miami at Marlins Park in Miami, and it is a char-grilled Miami Mex dog, and it's topped with chili con carne, Monterey Jack cheese, cilantro coleslaw, and jalapeno lime aioli, and it's wrapped in flour tortillas rather than a bun. It's their way of incorporating a Caribbean twist on the classic American hot dog.
Wow. See, I never thought of the Monterey Jack on a hot dog.
Flour tortilla too.
Yeah,
now
yes.
You know, when they describe it seems so obvious now.
Yeah.
There's also differences in what fans want. So in Chicago, for example, fans really insist on a steamed hot dog rather than a grilled one. Whereas, you know, in Phoenix, they have a grilled dog, and it's wrapped in bacon and topped with pico de gallo, pinto beans, and a little mayonnaise. It's called a Sonoran dog, and it's basically a hot dog with a southwestern twist. Chicago fans are especially particular about hot dogs, both Cubs fans and White Sox fans, and Levy makes a Chicago dog that has a Vienna beef hot dog, and it's served on a poppy seed bun. And both the bun and the hot dog are steamed rather than grilled. They have onions, tomato wedges, a pickle sphere, peppers, celery salt, yellow mustard, and bright green relish. Apparently, the bright green color is a non-negotiable in Chicago.
If you ask for the hot dog without it, you're told to get out.
Exactly. It's got to be neon green, too. There's no artisanal, all-natural twist on that relish. It's got to be neon green.
That's great. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. Her piece is called Get Your Hot Dogs Here, a Ballpark Tour Ahead of the Start of the Major League Season. What else did you find?
In L.A., at Dodger Stadium, last year, this company, Levy's Restaurant, sold about 2.5 million hot dogs during baseball season at Dodger Stadium. And its regional twist on the hot dog there is a quarter-pound hot dog that's topped with pineapple salsa, and it's served on a sweet tasting bun made from King's Hawaiian bread. And that hot dog strives to achieve, I guess, an extra sweetness combination to the salty garlic of the hot dog.
Now, mouth is watering. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. It's never too late to fall in love all over again. A 90-year-old British World War II veteran said he is finally getting married to his wartime sweetheart after spending the past 72 years regretting calling off their first engagement in 1944. Roy Vickerman told ABC News that he first met Nora Jackson, who's now 89, while attending school back in 1940 when they were both 13. They were a match. And Mr. Vickerman says they wrote each other while he was abroad serving the British Army. Says they got engaged just before he went overseas, but when he came home, he thinks he had post-traumatic stress disorder and just wanted to be alone, so he called off the engagement. After separate lives over seven decades, they both eventually lost their spouses, but Mr. Vickerman last year called a BBC radio show to express his regrets. A producer for the show tracked down Mrs. Jackson. Mr. Vickerman shook off the jitters after a month and finally showed up at her home with flowers. She recognized him instantly. And about 2 weeks ago, he proposed, and he offered her the ring he'd kept since the first proposal in 1944. How about that? For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy for you to create your stunning website. Go to Wix.com and create your website today. It's easy and free. That's Wix.com.